The first reading is from 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. That's on page 1015. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. The second reading is from 1 Peter 2, verses 18 to 21. That's 1 Peter 2, verses 18 to 21. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing, when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. The third reading is from 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 to 17. That's 1 Peter 3, verses 8 to 17. Finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, have a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. But it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit.
Thank you very much, Richard. Keep that open in front of you, and we'll get dug into this. Hello. And lovely to see you this evening. And as we said, this is the third in our three-part series on work. And I want to just start by a little reminder of where we've got to so far with this question. What do you think makes a job worthwhile or satisfying? What do you think makes a job worthwhile or satisfying? Here's some answers for what our society looks for. Firstly, the money. Apart from the ridiculous, unusual jobs like Premier League footballer or an actor, which I think are just in a completely different category, did you know that the current top highest earnings, current top five highest earning jobs in the UK are as follows? Number one, CEOs and other senior directors of companies. Number two, judges. Number three, senior consultants in hospital. Four, actuaries and risk managers. And then five, enterprise architects. Does anyone know what that is? I had to look it up. Apparently it's something to do with IT. Excuse my ignorance. So maybe it's the money. Maybe it's the jobs that sound really fun. I had a look on the Reed recruitment website this week and searched for what I thought the most fun jobs would be. And again, here's some genuine jobs that you could apply for today if you were interested. Number one, chocolate consultant. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah. Number two, beer taster. Number three, Lego sculptor. Or number four, this is genuinely a job, professional sleeper. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Maybe it's the money, maybe it's the fun, maybe it's the overall sense of satisfaction and achievement. There was a study published by the London School of Economics last week that found that when you factored that in, rather than just earnings, a lot of high-paid jobs actually don't come out that well. The key things, apparently, that lead to job satisfaction in surveys are personal responsibility for your own work and the chance to create or build something, especially if you see it completed. And so when you sort people's jobs out in that kind of way, actually, one of the top jobs for job satisfaction is to be a painter and decorator, because you get to see beautiful things finished off and everyone's always very chuffed with you. Anyway, those are the kind of things that our society looks for, I think. But we're in, as I say, our third week of this series. And the big thing that we've been seeing is that if you are a Christian, you already have the best job in the world. Not because you're necessarily doing the most exciting or the most high paid or the most satisfying thing, but because you have the best boss in the world, Jesus Christ. And because he's your ultimate boss, whatever you do can be done for his glory. Whatever you do has meaning and purpose. Whatever you do can be done to serve God and love your neighbor. And Andrew's helped us over the last couple of weeks think how, firstly, that helps us avoid the two very common mistakes of either making work into an idol, making it God, or being idle, being lazy. And it also, secondly, helps us with the supposed problem of work-life balance. Because actually, if Jesus is Lord of all of our life, he cares about us being faithful and fruitful in everything. In our work, with our family, with our friends, at church, and everything else. We have one boss, we have one mission in life, and so we can be integrated people. And tonight, finally, I want us to focus on evangelism at work, being ambassadors, as we've been thinking about all evening, for Christ at work. Because most of us spend most of our waking hours working. So how can we use that time to tell others of the life-giving news of Jesus? If we've got the best boss in the world, how can we share that with other people? And I know that that is very difficult in practice. I think it's a good thing in God's providence that I've ended up doing this third talk in the series, because I am not a full-time minister. I work full-time as a lawyer out there in the world, and I know the pressures. I know how hard it can be to get past basic pleasantries and really get to know your colleagues and have a good conversation with them. I know how frustrating it is that sometimes when you've done that and you've actually got into a bit of a friendship with someone at work, then they move on to another town or another job and it's gone. I know how careful you have to be these days about what you talk about or how you talk about some things, for fear of offending somebody accidentally or HR breathing down your neck. I know the way that just getting the job done means there's often very little time for anything else. I know. And so I hope I can really encourage you that being a good ambassador for Jesus at work is possible. And in fact, it's a wonderful privilege. I'm going to try and give some tips on how to go about that in a wise way, not mainly from my experience, but from others I've learned from and from Scripture. I want to try and arm you both theologically and a little bit legally on the possibility of getting pushback or opposition theologically, so you're not surprised or your confidence gets knocked when that happens, and legally, so you do actually know your rights and can defend yourself when opposition comes. And we're going to spend most of our time in the letter of 1 Peter, as Richard read for us. We are going to just think a little bit more widely as well, and a couple of other bits in the Bible. And we're going to try and do this a little bit like Andrew did over the last couple of weeks, slightly more discussion than we normally do in a sermon. So I'm going to throw things over to you at a couple of opportunities, just for a couple of minutes to talk to the people next to you and just start, hopefully, some really good conversations on this. And then, as Sam said, we're going to have a few of us up here at the front at the end to talk through these things a bit more. So let's dive in. And the first thing I want us to see is that being ambassadors for Jesus, working for Jesus, means being distinctively good. Did you see that in the way that Peter talks to the people of his day? The first thing about being a good ambassador, a good witness for Jesus at work, isn't actually about speaking of him. Although, as we're going to see, that is really important, and we'll get to it in a minute. But it starts with the distinctive way we act. Have a look again at 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 11 and 12 with me. Peter's just been reminding the people, the Christians he's writing to, of their status now in Christ. It's amazing status they have. And then he says this, "Beloved, I urge you, as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles," the non-Jews or the pagan peoples around them, "honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." The first thing that Peter urges the Christians to do, after reminding them what they are in Christ, is to be different. He says it in various different ways. You see that? So he says, abstain from the passions of your flesh, stop sinning. Or he puts it as, keep your conduct honorable. Or he says it very bluntly, do good deeds. I think they're all different angles on the same thing. We are to be distinctively good, godly, holy people in a world that is far from that. And as we do that, says Peter, others will notice. The people around us will notice. And even though some of them will still speak against us, others, or maybe even some of the same people, will see that we are doing good and will glorify God. In other words, the Holy Spirit will use our distinctive lives to convict people of their sin and bring them to Christ. We are to do good and follow in Christ's example, even when our master or our boss is unjust or unfair. Did you see that in the second passage? Verse 18, be subject to their masters with all respect, not only to the good and the gentle, but also the unjust. So specifically in the work context, this is what we have to do as well. So what does that look like? Well, Andrew's already helped us a bit with this in the last couple of Sundays, so I'm not going to go into it in loads of detail. Listen back to those two talks and have a think and chat more about it together. Because I think it'll be different for each of us in the specifics, depending on our job. But some things are definitely a common thread. And let me go into them for a second. But just as an aside, it's really worth trying to connect with other Christians who are in a similar field of work to you. And you'd be amazed how many great little Christian organizations there are in all sorts of fields of employment. You can go, if anyone wants to write this down, there's an excellent little website called transformworkuk.org. that has a list of loads and loads of Christian organizations in lots of different fields and occupations. Transformworkuk.org. But there are all sorts. There's the Christian Medical Fellowship, there's the Lawyers Christian Fellowship, there's an Association of Christian Teachers, there's a Christian Police Association, there's Christians in the Media, there's Christians in Politics, there's Kingdom Code for programmers, there's Morphe for those in the creative arts, and so on and so on and so on. Probably the kind of job you do, there'll be some other Christians in it, and they may well already have an organization which is helping you work out specifically what it means to be a good Christian employee or worker in that field. So have a look at that. But I mention that aside because I was actually just at a conference on Friday with the Lawyers Christian Fellowship. We were talking about a lot of this stuff. And obviously a lot of the stuff we were thinking about was specific to lawyers. But one speaker, I think, laid out a couple of really key principles that would apply to any of us. So here you go. These might be helpful starting points for conversation. Number one, integrity and trustworthiness. When you say you're going to do something, do it. I'm sure all of us are aware that that is surprisingly rare in a lot of workplaces. In a negative way as well, don't be the person that pads your expenses. Don't be the person that cut corners. We want to cultivate radical honesty. We want to be the people in our office or our school or our hospital or our wherever it is that people know they can trust. And we want to be the people who work hard even when we're not being scrutinized. So we want to be integrity and trustworthiness as our watchwords. Secondly, second big principle, love. Let's be known as the generous one at work. Let's be known as the kind one, the one that listens when people have problems. Let's be the person who takes an interest and makes sure we have time for people. And that might require sacrifice. That might mean that you're the one who has to stay a little bit late to finish up your work because you took that 15 or 20 minutes to spend chatting to someone over coffee. But let's be that person. And again, negative side, we've seen Peter says, flee from the passions of your flesh. Let's not gossip. I don't know about your workplace. Mine is a hive of gossip. It seems to be the main way that people kind of bond with one another is to moan about other barristers or the courts or the judge they were in front of or their opponent or whatever it was. And it's really hard not to join in on that, but try not to. You might well miss out on some of the news. I know I have. But believe me, people will notice. And not only will they notice you're different, but you'll find, or at least I have found over time, that you then get conversations with people where they'll come and tell you something because they know you're not the person who'll go and spread it somewhere else. They know you're trustworthy. They know you don't gossip. So integrity and trustworthiness, love. Thirdly, prayer. Pray about your work. It's obvious, but how many of us do it regularly? I know I often go through a whole day without failing and fail to do so. Let's pray for our work. Let's pray for our colleagues. Let's pray for our clients. And fourthly, hope. Might sound a strange one, hope. But I think it really is quite distinctive. Again, I'm not sure what your workplaces are like, but most people quite like a moan, don't they? I think that's quite a British thing as well. But most people like a moan. But let's try and be different. We have the most amazing hope in Jesus Christ. And yeah, that doesn't mean that every single day is wonderful. And don't be the insensitively cheerful person that bounces around with a smile on your face when everyone else is having a hard day. But do be the person who isn't cynical. Do be the person who's not on misery guts all the time. Do be the person who's not a complainer, who doesn't bring everyone down, but who lifts the mood, who's the can-do person, who's the positive person, who's the hopeful person. I wanted to just share with you as an illustration of this. It's not in the work context, but I found it very striking. We've been reading a little book by the Christian author Patricia St. John with the kids over the last few weeks. And it's a whole series of either true stories or fictional stories, kind of explaining different aspects of the Christian life. And there's this amazing little true story in it about some missionaries to China that illustrates, I think, what Peter's getting at here and the impact it can have. So these missionaries in China at the end of the 19th century were traveling around villages in Western China, selling some gospels, selling some tracts, selling some Bibles, and trying to speak of Jesus. And they go to one village, and there's not much interest in their message, but people are interested in these books because they're quite rare. And so they come along and they're asking about them. And they try and take the opportunity to speak of Jesus and the kind of person he was. And as they're doing this, one little old man goes, "Hang on, I know who you're talking about. I've met him." And the missionaries are like, "That's lovely. I'm glad that you think that. But he actually left this planet about 1900 years ago. I don't think you've actually met him in person." And this man is like, "No, definitely, I've met him. Like, the way you've described him, I've met that guy. I can take you to him. He lives in the next village. The missionaries are like, well, we're too good an opportunity to miss. Let's, you know, go along with this and see where it goes. So they trudge along to the next village, and they get there. And it's quite a poor village, and everything's a bit of a mess, but there's one little hut that looks a bit different. It's very tidy. There's not rubbish outside. And the man takes the missionaries up to this house and says, this is the house. This is where the man you're talking about lives. And they knock on the door, and this little Chinese man comes out, and they introduce him. And he says, what are you here for? And they say, we're here selling books. What about? Oh God, the Creator, and his son Jesus. And the man's face lights up. Jesus? Do you know him? Is he the same one I know? And he goes to a box at the back of his little hut and comes back with an old tattered copy of the Gospel of Mark and says, years ago I got this in the market and I read it cover to cover. I've never known someone like it. He's so good. I really wanted to be like him. So I've just been trying every day ever since to do what he would have done, to try and follow him. Do you know him too? And of course the missionaries then have this wonderful conversation and give him a full Bible, and he goes on to be part of the leadership of the church there. But isn't that a wonderful story? This little man hardly knew anything. He had one gospel, but he was so affected by the Jesus he met in those pages and so wanted to be like him that someone in the next village could, when they heard about Jesus, go, I know him. He's the guy down the road. Now, that's a pretty stark example, isn't it? But that's what we want to be like. We want the people in our workplaces, we want the clients that we're servicing, we want the patients we visit, the school pupils we're teaching, whatever it is, to, when they hear about Jesus, go, I think that sounds familiar. I think that sounds a bit like Sam, a bit like Liz. Let's be distinctively good. So here's your first little bit of homework. I'm just going to give you 2 minutes, turn in pairs, and have a look at the first question, which should come up, hopefully. What would it look like to be distinctively good in your workplace, and in what ways would living as a disciple of Christ most cause you to stand out in a good way? Right, I hope that's just the start of some conversations that we can really keep going this evening. You're going to get a couple more chances to follow those up, and then also, as we say, the application panel at the end. So we'll keep going, but do keep those conversations running along. So that's the first thing. So the first thing we need to do is be distinctively good in our workplaces. The second thing is, we then need to be ready to speak of Jesus. And the question is, so how does one lead to the other, right? How is it that being distinctive leads to people hearing about Jesus from us? Well, I think if you focus in on chapter 3, verse 15 of 1 Peter, we get the answer. Chapter 3, 15. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. There's another example of the be distinctive, right? We should be honoring Christ as holy in our hearts. Always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. That word defense is actually the word apologia, which doesn't just mean an apology. It means a kind of reasoned argument, a reasoned explanation, a response when someone asks a question. So here's how I think Peter expects this to work out. What he thinks is going to happen is that Christians are going to go out there into the world and be really distinctive, be really different ambassadors for Jesus. And people are going to notice that, and they're going to ask questions. They're going to say, why are you staying late to get that done? Or why are you not staying late and getting home to your family or getting back to your church small group, whatever that is? They're going to want to be friends and ask what we got up to at the weekend or a midweek evening because we're really nice, helpful people. They're going to want to confide in us when things are tough because we're the person who can be trusted, who doesn't gossip. And when those things happen, that will give us opportunities to speak of our hope in Jesus. And so we should expect that to happen, and we should be ready. We should be prepared, and we should pray for it. And that doesn't, before you get worried, that doesn't, I think, at all mean any special apologetics course or learning kind of how to answer the top 20 difficult questions about Christianity. Now, those things are great to do. It's really good to dig deep into the big questions about Christianity. It's really good to think deeply about a Christian worldview and what it has to say on the issues of the day. But that's just a really good thing to do in and of itself. It'll be great to your own faith and your own discipleship. It's not a means to be able to smartly answer questions that people give you. Because our answers, when people ask us to give a reason for the hope that we have, should be personal. They should be real. They should be the overflow of our own ongoing relationship with God and our developing discipleship in the way of Jesus. And did you see how Peter emphasizes we should speak about these things? He says we must do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience. It is vitally important that when we speak of Jesus, we are ambassadors not only in what we say, but how we say it. If we do this in the way that Peter says, gentle, respectful, with a good conscience, not only will we be more persuasive, but also much less likely to face bad consequences. Because if somebody objects, and they may still do so, or opposes us, others will see that that opposition is just unfair, and they will be put to shame. I was going to recommend for you all on this a really good little booklet that's just been published by the Evangelical Alliance called Living for Jesus at Work. I've got a copy here if you want to have a look at it later. You can also get it online. Just search for it. And it's a really good little primer on some advice on how to be a good witness at work. Tells you what the law is and what your rights are. Goes through some kind of specific tricky conscience issues. Goes through some things about workplace culture and how to navigate it. Just a really good resource. And in that, there's a little mnemonic, a little kind of memory thing to help us remember some good tips on how to do this well, how to speak for Jesus with gentleness and respect. And it uses the acronym SPEAK, just to be extra helpful. So here we go, SPEAK. And I think we've got them up on the screen as well, so I'll go through them quickly. S, speak. S, start with prayer. Start with prayer. We should be saturating our whole lives in prayer, and particularly our work lives. Pray for your work. Pray for opportunities to speak of Jesus. Can you pray maybe with a colleague? There's lots of different ways to handle this. You've got to be sensitive. But most people, especially if they're having a hard time and they've shared something with you, will be pleased if you say, do you mind if I pray for you? So take that opportunity. Start with prayer. P, prioritize your work. That's basically the first point I've just spent my whole time talking about. You want to be the perfect employee. You want to be the perfect colleague. You want to be the person who the context of any conversation you're having is one where people trust you and see that you're living out what you're talking about. And also just a really practical thing, a really good thing to do is if you get a conversation started at work, and it's going to take a while, it's going to be a good conversation, why don't you suggest, look, let's take that outside work. You're there to work, right? You're not going to annoy your boss by spending the whole time having this conversation. You say, can we take that outside work and let's meet up and actually talk about it in a more personal context? It's really useful in two ways. One, it shows I'm being a good employee, I'm here to work, but I'm also really interested in you, the person you're talking to. Also, legally, you're a lot more protected. If you take it outside the work to your private life, there's very little your employee can criticize you for. So make it personal. So start with prayer, prioritize your work. E, explain what you believe. This is the kind of 1 Peter thing encapsulated. Always be ready to give an answer. Give an explanation. Did you know that if you're asked a question, even a question about something really quite controversial, if you say something that is rooted in your Christian faith, if you quote the Bible, if you say, well, I believe Jesus says this, you have way more legal protection than if you just say, well, my opinion is. So if you make it explicitly religious, the law gives you a lot of protection for that conversation. Whereas if you try and dodge it a little bit and say, oh, well, you know, I kind of think maybe this, or then actually there's much less protection. So there's a legal incentive to be really explicit about your faith if you get into a difficult conversation. But also, I think, I really want to emphasize the explain. You want to get into a good conversation with people, right? An ongoing natural discussion is always better than a forced, isolated occasion. Try and foster a culture of conversation about all sorts of things, including faith, with your colleagues. And just try and mention your faith naturally and frequently in conversation. And then, if somebody does pick up on it and they want to speak more about it, it doesn't feel like a big thing. It's just normal for part of your life. Okay, explain. Fourth, aim to build a gospel bridge. Aim to build a gospel bridge. Where there is an opportunity to share your Christian faith with someone, it's important to ask questions to see where they're coming from, as well as you saying what you believe. The more you take a genuine interest in someone else's life and worldview, the more likely they are to want to hear yours. Mary and I have just been reading a really good book. It's sort of on a completely different topic. It's about hospitality. But it's called The Gospel Comes with a House Key. Really good, really radical. Highly recommend it. There's a lovely little nugget in there that I think is really helpful on this. The writer, Rosaria Butterfield, says, "Our words should never be stronger than the relationship. Our words should never be stronger than the relationship." If you know someone really well, if you've really got to know them, if you've made it obvious that you love them, you can say quite a hard thing because they know you love them, because they know you care, because they know you. If you don't know someone, you probably can't say something very strong because the relationship can't bear it. Now, like any principles, it's not always going to apply, but I think as a basic guideline, it's really helpful. So let's really get to know our colleagues and have an ongoing conversation with them. And then finally, okay, know when to stop. And this is not, I don't want to encourage you to use this as an excuse not to talk. This whole thing is about let's be ambassadors for Christ, let's speak. But it's a useful little caution. You want to ensure that the respect you want to be afforded your Christian faith is also afforded by you to others. Because we want workplace cultures where everyone is able to freely talk about who they are with respect and tolerance for each other. So if you're talking to a colleague about your faith, make sure they're happy to talk about it. If they're keen, great, run with it. If they're not that interested, that's fine. You leave it. And that's particularly important if you're in a position of authority, because you need to be really sensitive to the kind of power dynamics involved. If a colleague, especially a junior colleague, makes it clear that faith discussions are unwelcome to them, don't pursue it. God's in control. Ultimately, it's him who will bring people to Christ. We just have the privilege of being involved. And so if it's not going to be appropriate, just leave it and just pray for them. So there, I hope that helps as a kind of top tips. Back over to you guys again for a couple of minutes to keep the conversations going, and then we'll come back for my final section. And the discussion point this time is a very simple one. Have you had opportunities to speak of Jesus to colleagues or others at work? And if not, why not? Great, okay. Once again, I'm sorry to interrupt. I really want you to keep those conversations going, but I'm going to jump in with our third and final thing to think about this evening, which is this. People won't always like it, but God will be glorified. People won't always like it, but God will be glorified. Because even if you just live really distinctively, and it's the outflow of that that's these good conversations. And even if you're really wise and really loving and really gentle and respectful in your conversations and follow all those tips, you know what? You might still get opposition. And we do need to make sure the opposition is solely because of the gospel and not for other reasons. There was well, something importantly, of course, that Peter himself says. Have a look again at chapter 2. Verse 20. What credit is it when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? If you do good and suffer for it when you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. So let's not be people who get into trouble because we have in fact done something wrong. There was a case a few years ago, I think, which exemplified this, which got quite a lot of headlines. There was a case about a nurse who tried to tell her colleague the gospel and was disciplined for it. And it sounded like a really terrible example of kind of nasty HR squashing someone's attempt to be evangelistic at work. The sad thing, though, was that when the actual facts came out, it turned out that she was the line manager of a much more junior Muslim colleague. And she invited this Muslim colleague to a Christian event, and the Muslim junior colleague very politely said, "No, thank you, I'm not interested." And then she kept pestering her and kept sending her things and kept trying to talk to her about it. And that's why she was disciplined. And I'm afraid I think the answer to that is quite right. Because if we'd flipped that round and it'd been the junior colleague who'd been a Christian and the more senior colleague who'd been a Muslim, we'd all have been outraged. That's not the kind of witness that Peter invites us to do. So I throw that in just to be kind of, let's make sure we're not in that situation. But, even if we are model employees, we might still face pressure. In fact, Peter expects it for speaking for Jesus. Did you see that Peter expects it? So he says, chapter 2, verse 12, when they speak against you. Not if, when. Or verse 18, he assumes some of us will have unjust masters. Not everyone's got a good boss. Or in chapter 3, verse 16, we must have a good conscience so that when you are slandered, not if. And after all, Jesus, who spoke of God perfectly and was the perfect man, was opposed to the point of death. And he promised us in John chapter 15 that a servant is not greater than his master. If the world hated me, they will also hate you. Christians being made fun of and unfairly accused of being judgmental or narrow-minded or all sorts of other things is not new. It may feel that way. It may feel like our culture is becoming more hostile, and I think in some ways it is, but it's not new. In the Roman world, vicious rumors circulated that Christians were rebellious because they refused to acknowledge Caesar as God rather than just emperor. There were rumors that the Lord's Supper involved human sacrifice. The Christians were accused of undermining all manly virtues because they happened to be very popular with slaves and women, and so on and so on. And we should expect to feel uncomfortable at times and have situations in our work where our conscience as Christians comes into conflict with the demands of our workplace. We might find a situation where we're being pressured to do something dishonest or deceitful. Or it might be that what we believe comes into conflict with the views of others, and they're not willing to be tolerant and live and let live. Because as Peter says, we are sojourners and exiles. Or to put it in more modern terms, we are refugees. We are migrants in this world. Our true home is heaven and the new creation to come. So this is nothing new. And it's not just in the New Testament, but throughout the history of God's people. So what do we do, and how do we decide when to take a stand and how to respond when it happens? Well, I want to take a few, sort of wise principles from one example from the Old Testament, and then throw it again, finally, over to you guys for some discussion. We could go to various heroes of the Old Testament who ended up in this kind of situation, but I think a really helpful one for us is Daniel. Don't need to turn it up. I'm just going to throw out some thoughts from Daniel, and then you can look at it later. But if you know the story of Daniel and his friends, you know they're carted off from their home in Israel to Babylon, into exile. And they're young. They're probably teenagers at the time. And they are taken off to be part of the Babylonian education system. They're going to be groomed to be the new civil servants in the ancient and impressive empire of Babylon. And they essentially go along with an awful lot of it. They go and they learn the Babylonian customs and the Babylonian language and the Babylonian law. They even have their names changed. They don't protest at that. But they do take a stand. And if you remember in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel resolved with his friends that he would not defile himself with the king's food or the wine that he drank. And so they ask the chief of the eunuchs, the HR director or the university chancellor, to allow them not to defile themselves. So in every other way, they're model students. They pursue excellence, and they accept their lot, but they do draw a line somewhere, and God honors them for it. And I think we learn some things from the way that Daniel and his friends go about this. I think we learn that you do have to pick your battles, and that not everyone might choose every single issue exactly the same way to be distinctive on or to take a stand on, and Christians might land in slightly different places. I think when you read this, I think it's really odd that it's food and drink they decide to make a stand on rather than having their name changed or being forced to wear all the Babylonian clothes and learn all the Babylonian gods. it's this thing they choose. And I think the key thing seems to be they choose something. There's something that they're distinctive on. So let's not judge one another if we take different, slightly different stances on tricky things in the workplace. Let's just really encourage one another to think it through, pray about it, and then reach a conclusion in good conscience, but be willing to stand distinctively on something. Second thing I think we see is you should be distinctively Christian early in your workplace or in your setting. So Daniel starts being distinctive and standing for the God of Israel in his youth when they first get there. And I think that shows you why he's then able to stand all the way through his life and is the total hero when it comes to the lion's den right at the end of his life. He started by making a stand, and so he was able to stand when the real pressure came. Same with his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're distinctive in this issue, and so they're able to stand when the golden statue in the fiery furnace comes. Don't think, if you've basically just kept your head down until now, that when something really bad comes up at work, you'll then take a stand. I hope you will. I pray that you will. But I think it'll be a lot harder. It's worth taking a stand on something early that doesn't really matter that much, just to be seen to be Christian. And then thirdly, I think, again, it's another example of make sure it's your love for Jesus and your desire to follow his teaching that's the only thing people can take offense at. I think one thing that's really striking in the story of Daniel is that when, as an old man and as the highest possible official, people are getting jealous and want to try and get rid of him, they look and look and look, and it says this: the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground of complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, for he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We will find nothing against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." That's amazing, isn't it? Daniel was effectively the prime minister for several decades in Babylon, through lots of different kings, lots of different changes of power, and they could find nothing against him apart from his faith. Can you imagine that? Can you even name a politician who's not had any scandal about them? It's an astonishing record, and that's what we need to aim for. So there's some lessons I think we learn from someone like Daniel. But we, of course, are in a much better position than Daniel, because we're not in an absolute totalitarian monarchy where we can be thrown into a fiery furnace, praise the Lord. We're in a liberal democracy with still very strong protections for religious freedom and against religious discrimination in the workplace. And so I want to just end by giving you some kind of encouragement on how to navigate some tricky issues. And then we're going to deal with one example and then finally hand it back over to you guys to carry on the conversations. So here's just some key information that it's worth knowing. And again, I would really recommend this little booklet if you want to pick it up and read it or get a copy online. It'll tell you a lot more. But some really key things to know, because I know that there are some difficult issues to navigate in the workplace right now, and a lot of them are around issues like diversity and inclusion, and the tension in particular between some of the LGBT agenda and Christian beliefs. Let's name it. That's probably the key thing. But I want to give you some encouragement. So firstly, let's remember that diversity, inclusion, equality, they're all Christian ideas. They come from the Bible. So we should be confident about them and lean into them. Don't be afraid. Get involved. You sign up for your Equality and Diversity Committee. You get in there because we've got a lot of really good stuff to say about it. And make the point that religious diversity is included. Diversity includes religious diversity, includes tolerating, understanding different beliefs. Secondly, know that the law does that too. So the Equality Act, which is the main piece of law on all of this, protects 9 different forms of protected characteristic, it's called, equally. There's no hierarchy. And one of them is religion and belief. So it is illegal to directly discriminate against a Christian, i.e. fire you because you're a Christian or you say something Christian. It's illegal to indirectly discriminate against you on the grounds of your religion. So, for instance, rostering duties on a Sunday and making no exception might be illegal. They can't justify it. Banning all religious groups from the workplace, unless it can be justified for some specific reason, is probably illegal. it's illegal to harass somebody because of their faith. So if there's loads of anti-Christian jokes in your workplace, or you're being pestered to make active support for a pride march, or whatever it is, that's probably illegal. It's illegal to victimize people for their faith. So if you're treated unfavorably because you've raised a concern about some integrity issue, that's illegal. And I want to just pick one example that's maybe quite topical on how to start thinking through some of these things. And then, as I say, I'll hand it over to you guys to do a bit more thinking. Here's one that's been a real issue for quite a lot of people in the last just literally 2 years. What do you do if your workplace suddenly asks you to include your preferred pronouns in your email signature or introduce yourself with pronouns at a meeting? Well, here's just some ways to think through that issue, and I hope you can apply the same kind of things to others like it. First of all, I think Christians can come to different conclusions on that, and that's okay. Okay, as long as you've thought it through, talked about it with some Christian friends, and your conscience is clear, I'm happy. You know, do what you think's right. I personally do not put pronouns in an email, or wouldn't introduce myself with them, and I wouldn't do that. Secondly, the idea behind it is that it's done out of a good desire to be inclusive of people, especially trans people, and also sometimes interesting to help with cross-cultural differences. If you're not familiar with the culture's names and you're not sure whether they're male or female, it's giving you an indication, which could be quite helpful. But, third, actually, some people with gender dysphoria find that practice very unhelpful and very upsetting. Did you know that? Because it forces them to confront gender language all the time, and it pressurizes them potentially to out themselves. So it's not potentially actually that useful for some of the people who it's supposed to help. And fourth, it's often taken as a sign that you accept all aspects of gender identity ideology, most of which, I don't have time to go into this now, but is profoundly wrong, destructive, and unbiblical. And although there hasn't been a court case on this point yet, it is likely that the law will protect you if a manager tries to compel you to put pronouns in an email signature or use them when you don't feel you can in good conscience. Because the belief that you shouldn't do that is a protected belief in law. So I think there's freedom. And I want you to feel empowered that there is freedom on that issue and that you can engage with gentleness and respect on an issue like that, confident that your faith can be protected. But living for Jesus at work will sometimes lead to these kind of questions. Again, this little booklet, if I can recommend it one last time, deals with some of the other things that might come up. But I want to come back to the key thing. We want to be the model employee. So we want to be the person who, if one of these issues comes up, we're known as the person who's really helpful, who's really reasonable, who's really loving. And so if we want to take a stand on this, it's in that context. Okay, we're going to finish there. I'm going to hand back to you guys for 2 more minutes before Sam, or I think actually Andrew, comes up to the application session. And there's a final discussion question. Share any examples of hostility you've experienced towards expressions of faith or being distinctively Christian in your workplace. Have a quick chat about that, and then Andrew and the others are going to come up to join us for application.
Okay. Nice one. Let me just invite Ellie and Liz up to join me here. So I think I know most folks, but if not, my name's Andrew, part of the team. So I did the intro bit of the series last week and the week before, and thank you, Ali, for taking it on this evening. And so we thought, in order to get a little bit more of a sort of a spread of different jobs and kind of reflections on this, and reflections not just from today but from the whole series, we'd invite Ellie and Liz up. And so to begin, I've introduced you, Liz, Ellie. Tell us what you do, work-wise, series on work, and then a little bit about, so in week one we thought about how our work is good because God is good and we are workers like him, and part of our work is bringing order out of chaos. So work is good But then after the fall, work is also pretty grim sometimes. So tell us a bit about the work that you do, where you see goodness as you bring order out of chaos, but also maybe where you see a little bit of the grimness.
So I am an audiologist. So audiology is sort of the study of sound and balance, so ear-related things. And in terms of the goodness, our bread and butter is fitting hearing aids. And so if someone has a hearing loss and we fit them with a hearing aid, then probably 9.5 times out of 10, they will do very well with it. And they can hear their family, have conversations with people, and sort of things like that. So I guess maybe the order out of chaos is even in the fallen world where our bodies are aging, or there are disease and air conditions, then and people are struggling to hear, then there is opportunities for, and on the NHS as well, to be able to have hearing, their hearing aided, supported, and sort of increasing their hearing potential. In terms of the grimness, I work for the NHS, and so, not to say that is grim, I love the NHS, but I think just the challenges in terms of being just very, very pressured. We are, I guess, overworked, underpaid, and just some of the things that we'd want to do. So I worked in a department on placement many, many years ago, where there was only funding to fit a patient with only one hearing aid, and there was like a 2-year waiting list for a second hearing aid. And so, is probably unheard of now. But that was sort of the grimness or the dire situation that that department was in at the time.
I'm a secondary school teacher, so I teach geography, and I'm also head of sick form in a school in Dagenham. And I think schools are quite chaotic. Classrooms full of teenagers are very chaotic. And so I think just as a teacher, it is your job to bring order out of chaos because you're trying to get them to be quiet and get on with each other enough so that they can learn something. But I also think that, especially because I work more with sick form increasingly, they have so many fantastic ideas and so much knowledge, but they really don't know how to process that. So they will just info dump. If you've ever read like an essay or a personal statement first draft, it's just chaotic. So you're trying to bring order out of that by teaching them how to process the ideas and their thought processes and take that information and turn it into an ordered and critical argument, which will be useful for them in whatever they go on to do in life. It'll make them more articulate, so they'll hopefully go on and go to university or get a job or an apprenticeship in which they will then be able to contribute to society as a critically thinking and well-rounded individual. And it's pretty grim that I have to get on the district line at like 7 a.m. and it's going to be dark soon and it's going to be really sad. Yeah.
That is grim. Hold on to that, Ellie, if you go first on the next one. So also, Ali reminded us this evening of that those twin pitfalls that we can fall into of either making our work into an idol or being idle in our work. But then we also thought about how, well, we have the best job in the world because Jesus is our boss now. How does that truth help you not fall into either idle or idle, whichever your inclination might be?
I think my inclination is more that work is an idol. I think that, I know that there's lots of jobs like this, but I think with teaching you can put in endless hours and you still will never be done. And I'm seeing people nodding. And I feel like if you're like, want to make the perfect lesson that is perfectly differentiated for every single child in the room, and you've built in stretch tasks, but you've also built in sentence structures, you could do that, but you would never leave school, and you'd also have no life outside of school. And you could mark everything absolutely perfectly, but then you would be completely burnt out. So it's that balance of trying to think you want to do your job well to honour God, but you also don't want to burn out, because that's not a good way of honouring God either. And you want to be able to go to church and to Bible study as well.
In fact, on that, let me just move on to, we'll come back to you in a moment, Liz. Just on, because you've mentioned balance, we thought a bit about that last week, kind of balancing work and church and family. And in particular, we've got this new mission to love God and neighbour. Where are some of the challenges of juggling work, church, other commitments, and how do you balance those?
I think that I get really tired in the evenings, and I'm also quite emotionally exhausted, and I'm also a bit of an introvert. So by the end of the day, I've had enough people, because I've had like 100 teenagers. talking at me all day. And so I feel like it's quite hard for me to do things in the evenings, midweek. And so I think that I really prioritize coming to Bible study every week, even if I'm feeling tired and even if I feel like actually I've not got that much to contribute. I prioritize coming to Bible study in midweek groups. And I try to make sure I get here early, because then I can leave at like 9, but I've still had like 10, 15, 20 minutes to chat to people before the service, so I prioritize being early so that I can leave on time so I can get back and go to bed, which is what I want to be doing. Around 9 o'clock, I'm ready to go to sleep at 9, to be honest, so yeah.
Thank you. Liz, back to the question of idol versus idol. How does that land for you, and how does remembering that Jesus is your boss help, whichever direction it goes?
I'm probably the opposite to Ellie, in that if I had the opportunity to not do anything, then I wouldn't. I think my temperament lends me to sort of that way, to be quite relaxed. Sometimes I'm horizontal when I'm relaxed, and so. But I think at work, one thing I've learned is that work is no fun if you have nothing to do at work and you have to be there for 10 hours. And so, I guess God in His kindness has helped me to have a better mindset that when I'm at work, I'm at work. There are things to do. And I think because I've got sort of a higher position role now, then working for the Lord and everything that I do, I'm supposed to be doing that unto the Lord and so for His glory. But also I want to be an example to my other colleagues as well, and to, I guess, have a good reputation, not just for myself, but to bring honour to the name of Christ and not to dishonour His name while I'm at work, particularly if I'm known as a Christian.
Thank you. Well, that moves swiftly into the last area. So thinking a little bit about what Ali was talking about this evening, what would or what does it look like for you to be kind of distinctively good, distinctively different in your workplace because of being a Christian?
I think probably many workplaces, but including mine, people are really out for themselves. And so as well as sort of doing hearing aids work, we also, there's vestibular stuff, so like balance and dizziness, as well as sort of tinnitus, so tinnitus management, helping people manage sort of ringing in their ears and how to live with that. And tinnitus is not really my bag, but I really enjoy the diagnostics and sort of dizzy work.
Could say that you're a dizzy rascal. My apologies, please carry on.
With my new role, I had the opportunity to completely give up tinnitus, and my colleague, who's just starting in her and take on more vestibular work, but my colleague who has just sort of started sort of in her vestibular and sort of wanting to go down that career path, so I had the opportunity to either give up half a day of that and give it to her and take on tinnitus, so we swap, or I keep it for myself. And I think in a world or in a workplace where everyone is really trying to sort of get the experience that they need, so that if they want to stay or go somewhere else and go work somewhere else, I just thought I've been doing it for slightly longer, and giving up half a day won't necessarily, I don't think that will affect me, but I think it will do her the world of good, and she needs that training, which I don't know, maybe many places, why would you give something up which would benefit you to then benefit someone else? So, and also, so I think, I remember one thing that Laura Dancer, or formerly Laura Dancer, said in terms of in terms of talking to people about Jesus or sort of trying to bring Jesus into conversations, or just making that just a natural part of your conversation. So one thing I've been trying to do, particularly if people share things with me, whether it's good things or sort of bad things, I'll be praying for that. I'll pray for you and to say that explicitly to them. And I think because in recent years, I think I'm less, more explicit maybe in what I say in terms of sort of verbally identifying as a Christian or this is what I believe. I think that's been a way that I've been trying to really be more vocal and be more, out there with my faith. And yeah.
Ellie, what about for yourself?
I think that my workplace is very chaotic and there are often a lot of things that you can legitimately be quite upset about and therefore end up moaning about, like, for example, due to budget cuts, they've massively limited the amount that we're able to print, and they've completely blocked all of the students' printing, which now means that we're using up our limited printing credit to print off things for the students, which they need, which then means we can't print off other things. And that is something that is actually very difficult to work around, and that's something that we are having to think about. But I think it is very, very easy to join in the moaning and to just complain constantly, and also it becomes very personal quite quickly, with people targeting senior leadership and saying, well, it's this this head teacher's, there's one head teacher, this assistant head teacher's fault, and they're not doing their job properly. And it is, I feel like that can get quite toxic, and also be very, like, you can, if you join in on that, it can make you less distinctive. So it's trying not to join in on that, and also trying to find solutions to those issues, because I think sometimes you just moan for moaning's sake. And actually, it's more helpful and more distinctive. You think, right, okay, this is a problem. How could we solve this? What could be done that would be productive? And I hope that that is quite distinctive, and something that I'm trying to do more is join in less with the moaning and more solutions-based. Yeah.
Thank you. Guys, thank you very much. That's been really helpful reflecting on some of those things, including some of the things coming out, you know, sort of like love for colleagues by, you know, taking on extra things, being different. I think the not gossiping thing is just massive, isn't it? If you are the person who just never gossips, that just makes you so different in almost every workplace. You know, when we were talking beforehand, each of you were like, my workplace is so gossipy. Ali was like, my workplace is so gossipy. I think that might be a workplace thing. And yeah, those little things that we can do to make us very, very different, so that people might ask us a reason for the hope that we have. We were going to sing, but the pizza is going to be getting cold. And it would be great to carry on talking about these things, reflecting on them, chatting. As Ali said, I think it's really helpful to speak to other people in a similar field to yourself, maybe someone who's been working in that area for longer, to kind of talk about these things. A few of the guys that I work with in the city, we reflected back afterwards and were like, wow, we'd do things really differently if we were there now. And if only someone who is further on than us had spoken to us at the beginning, that would have been really helpful. So those people are out there. Let's try and find them.